This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Tuesday morning radio zine. First on Between the Covers, host Emily Young interviews Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the memoir Eat, Pray, Love, One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. At 9:30, the guest is economist Jared Bernstein, author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. We'll also check in with the Oxygen Collective. They are challenging the Bush administration's plans to clear-cut forests in Oregon's largest unprotected roadless areas. At 10, the guests are Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old peace activist who was killed in 2003 when she was crushed by a bulldozer on the Gaza Strip. The Coreys will discuss the first annual PeaceWorks conference, which will be held this weekend in Olympia. At 10:30 on stage and studio, Willamette Radio Workshop presents 4 Hours from Omaha by Craig Kenworthy, an original radio play dealing with an elder woman's attempt to balance her life. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, topics include outrage in Milwaukee over an all-white jury's decision to acquit 3 white police officers charged with brutally beating an African-American man. And legendary Nigerian playwright Nigerian playwright Wole Soyinka talks about the ongoing crisis in Darfur. Now here's Between the Covers.
Joining me in the studio is Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, among other things. Among other things, you worked for Spin. You've written for GQ. How long did you work for Spin?
I worked for Spin for about 5 years, but I really had no business working for Spin because I did that in my early 20s. I'm now 36. My beat was like writing about weird subcultures in America and going to like Renaissance fairs and stuff and writing about people like that. And I never knew any of the people who were ever on the cover of Spin. And I used to sit in editorial meetings in fear, living cold, icy fear that somebody was going to call on me and say, "Who do you think we should have on the cover?" And I would be like, Paul Simon. He's nice.
Cute.
He writes songs, right? You know, like I'm just so woefully unhip.
But you're not woefully unhip. You wrote a well-received book about Eustace Conway.
The Last American Man.
And you decided you needed to take off, you needed to get out of Dodge, and you did.
Yeah.
How did you do it? Why did you do it? And what was your impetus? I mean, other than, you know, having that horrible divorce and everything, was there something else?
Well, I've always been, I'm a traveler, and I think traveling is a good remedy for almost anything. And I had felt so suffocated in my marriage and in the house that we had bought and the furniture that we had and all the stuff that we had acquired. And I was around the age of 30, and I was supposed to have a baby, and I didn't want to have a baby, and I didn't know what to do about that. And, it was just this complete, like, meltdown of self. And then, you know, finally, I mean, I'm really summarizing. Basically, what ended up happening was that I finally left. I left the marriage. And then I've always been a big believer in the healing powers of the grandiose gesture, you know? So I decided to just go on a good old-fashioned quest. And I was looking for parts of my humanity that I felt had been corroded during all that depression and divorce and despair. And I was looking for those particular elements of myself set against cultures that specialize in that particular thing. So that was the plan. Go to Italy for 4 months, explore the art of pleasure. Go to India for 4 months, explore the art of devotion. And go to Indonesia, to Bali, for 4 months and look for the art of balance between pleasure and devotion.
So you had a complete plan, all mapped out,
yeah,
ready to go.
Yeah, New England girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very organized.
And yes, it sounds like it. Yeah. And in a way, I can't even begin to fathom. And yet you landed in Indonesia, for instance, without a plan.
Yeah, that was kind of the plan, to land in Indonesia without a plan.
So I mean, that was planned. Even that had to be planned.
You know, it's like there's such a delicate balance, I think, in planning. I mean, I do think that we are more likely to get answers in our lives if we ask specific questions, you know. So the journey was really organized in terms of what I was looking for. You know, I really had it lined up. I want to focus on this here, focus on this here, focus on this here. But I wasn't, you know, bound and determined how that had to come. You know what I mean? I sort of felt like if I go to Italy, if I go to Rome, I start learning Italian and I eat my brains out, I will find out everything I need to learn about pleasure.
And boy, did you.
Yeah. And I just trusted that, you know, if you set up the program, then once you get there, you can be very loose about how it actually occurs.
Did you plan on writing a book that would be a guide to a spiritual transformation like that? I mean, I know that sounds kind of heavy, and you're not that, and that's the way. I don't mean heavy. What do I mean? Woo-woo. That's what I mean. You're not woo-woo, and yet it is a woo-woo story. You have metaphysical experiences. Did you plan on writing a book that would act as some kind of a guide or yeah, you know, how to, you know, have a catharsis or something?
I mean, I didn't intend it so much as how other people should have catharses. It was more like, you know, I knew I was writing the book the whole time I was traveling, you know, and I knew that I wanted to write the book. You know, Joan Didion said once, I write in order to find out how I feel about things, right? So I wanted to write the book in order to help me figure out how I felt about everything that was going on and everything I was looking for in myself. Also, I feel like divinity and spirituality have been sort of co-opted by either, you know, the religious right or the woo-woo left. And there is a place, you know, like, you know, thoughts of the eternal and desires to comprehend our place in the universe belong to everyone, you know, even those of us who aren't like airy-fairy or, you know, fundamentalist Christians. You know, there is a sort of middle ground for a rational, thinking, interested, curious person who also has a yearning for some kind of transcendence. And so I think I wrote the book with that voice. Like, you know, like it's a practical consideration looking for God in a way.
But your particular form took place in India, in an ashram.
Yeah.
And involved thinking in terms of Kundalini Shakti and...
Yeah. So I definitely lean more toward the woo-woo left than the conservative.
I don't know
right.
That it's also woo-woo. It's, you know, it's just a different kind of a woo. It's not. They're very kind of laid back. Their religions there in India are so varied, from door to door. I mean, from block to block or whatever. So that, you know, it is more of the vague idea of a divinity than and it seems more tolerated.
Yeah, it's more Hinduism has a lot more wiggle room in it than
among itself, not necessarily
not
with
toward others.
Yes, exactly.
As an idea, I mean, not necessarily politically, you know, but you know, as a sort of pure religious idea, I think there's a lot of wiggle room in there.
Christianity is that way in this country to a respect. I mean, to a point, I think.
Yeah.
You know, as long as a friend of mine moved to Kentucky, and they, you know, what church do you go to is the second question.
Yeah.
In Bali, it's, you know, where you going, you say, in your book. And but there it's, what church do you go to?
Yeah.
And as long as you're in some kind of a church,
yeah,
you know, in each of these places, a different kind of spirituality, a different kind of institutionalized or not, you know, or form. And you sort of gathered from each of them, except not so much in Italy. In Italy was the food... Was religion food?
Yeah, there's a sacredness in Italy, too. It's so funny because I've been reading, when I've been doing readings, I read a little bit from each section. And when I read from the Italy section, I always read this one description of this amazing pizza that I had in Naples. And then when I'm done with it, I say, okay, now I'm going to turn to India and we're going to talk about divinity. But I always, when I hear myself say that, I always think, we just have been talking about divinity. We've been talking about, you know, the miraculous sensory life of a human, you know, to be able to enjoy these extraordinary sensory experiences, which is sacred and which is recognized as such in Italy.
Well, and you have a fun, obviously have fun with the language. It's why you were there. It's why it sounds like almost everybody who goes there to learn Italian, as you did, signing up to learn Italian, would go there. But just the love of the language. There's, as you say, there's no practical reason to learn Italian.
Yeah, I was in Italian language class with people from all over the world, and I never could dig out of anybody a single practical reason why anyone had to be there. Like, nobody's boss had said, you got to go learn Italian so that, you know, our exports can increase or whatever, you know, like, or it was just people had followed the love of the sound of the thing. Italian is so beautiful, you know, it's lyrical, it's sort of incandescent, it's got these waves of rhyme that sort of move through the language. It's just it's a poetic language, and people want to hear it in their ears and feel it in their mouths, and there's something really sensuous and sacred about that too.
And your language is very good too. You, like, for instance, "Oh, cold world," and when you're talking about the bathroom floors that you find yourself on, do you know that quote?
Oh, cold world, I'm so weary of you and all your bathrooms. You know,
all your bathroom floors.
And all your bathroom floors. Yeah, it's actually very funny because I've since learned that Anne Lamott, who's a terrific writer who writes about Christianity, said, "Some say God is in the details. I say God is in the bathroom." It seems like it's a place she also ends up. For some reason, a lot of my sort of beginning crawlings toward the idea of prayer happened on various bathroom floors in various states of total meltdown, you know, like middle of the night, crying in the bathroom, wondering if I should get a divorce, and thinking, you know, I don't know what else to do, so I'm going to give prayer a shot. I've heard that people do that. But I just ended up in bathrooms all over the world whenever I was in trouble. I don't know why. It's probably because it's, you know, where we do our most intimate thinking, so to
private.
Speak.
It's
our
private.
Most private moments are spent there. So,
But you ended up on the floor next to your bed because I imagine you didn't want to wake your lover at the time.
Yeah. I was doing a lot. There was a couple of years there where I was doing a lot of hiding from various men in bathrooms, crying because it wasn't working and I couldn't figure it out.
And you couldn't walk away.
I couldn't walk away. I couldn't stay. It's the only thing worse than staying is going. The only thing worse than going is staying. It's one of those horrible things that takes a long time to sort out sometimes.
It's like a train wreck you just couldn't walk away from, or...
You know, you get in the habit.
Do you think you get addicted to crying?
I don't know. The crying is so hard to stop once it starts for me. But, you know, I'm like that. I'm like a soup. You know, I've always been, my mom always said, you know, I was the perfect baby, happy, you know, until I turned 3, and then I started crying and I didn't stop till I was 15. And actually what she doesn't know is that I kind of didn't even really stop then. Like,
you moved to the bathroom.
You know, so I mean, I emote a lot. You know, I'm like an emotive person, so it's kind of how it is. But I barely, you know, you barely find me crying anymore these days, except when I'm chopping the onions.
And I know why. Because I read your book, Elizabeth Gilbert, Eat, Pray, Love, which, you know, as you know, it just kind of came at me really quickly. And you've separated it sort of ritualistically into the number of beads on a
japa mala.
Japa mala.
Yeah.
And the fact that was picked up by the Crusaders, that's just page one, so I'm not giving away too much, is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I wanted to have, the book is organized, you know, it's in 3 sections, one for Italy, India, and Indonesia, for each country. But then it's further separated into 108 beads, that's what I call them, because japa malas, which are the strings of beads that Hindus and Buddhists use for meditation, tend to have, it's like a rosary. In fact, we got the idea for rosary from, you know, the Crusades, when the Crusaders saw people in the East using prayer beads and brought the idea home. But they always have 108 beads on them in India, and 108 is considered to be this very auspicious number of balance. And so I decided that my book would have 108 chapters because I wanted it to, I did really want it to be sort of an offering, a spiritual offering, you know, and that's how you would do it in the East. You would repeat something 108 times, or you would, you know, make 108 intentions. There's always something to do around that number.
And being the organized person that you are.
Yeah, it keeps you in order, too.
That's
and
right.
I really do think that your quests, you know, are more likely to bear fruition if you have a destination, or if you're keeping a little bit in track. I mean, there's a time in your life for restless wandering, you know, and then there's a time in your life for disciplined searching. And this trip for me was not a walkabout. You know, this was not a sort of let's go in the car and see what happens if we turn left and then right and then go straight and then go backwards and see where we end up, you know. This was definitely a very serious attempt for me to renovate my own humanity, and I thought I needed to take it seriously. Which means, you know, getting organized a little bit. And then being willing to let things fall apart when they do, which they do.
Yes. Inevitably. Eventually. They'll dissolve.
Inevitably, ultimately. The thing about a journey is, I mean, you know, I won't be giving away too much for the book on this, I hope, but, you know, one of the reasons I went back to Bali was that I had been there a few years prior, and I'd had the great fortune to meet this 9th-generation elderly medicine man who read my palm, and in addition to making all sorts of other very bold proclamations, told me, you know, in no uncertain terms, that I was destined to come back to Bali and spend 3 or 4 months there living with him and his family, teaching him English while he taught me everything he knew. And I built my life around that, you know, for like 2 years. And that's like good old school questing. You know, you go on a journey, you meet some crone, they say you got to go do this thing, you go do the task, you come back, and the crone's like, no, you did it wrong, you've got to go do it again. You know, it's like this is a sort of theme that runs through heroic myths all over the place. So, you know, of course, I went all the way back to Bali. It took me like 2.5 years to go back to fulfill this grand destiny, you know, and he had no idea who I was, you know, or what I was doing there. And it's just the comedy of a human journey. Like, that's it. That's what happens. And yet, the fact that he made that proclamation is why this book exists. It's why that journey exists, because it all came from a place of me trying to get back to him, you know, and everything else that I learned along the way was what I needed more than what I thought I needed, which was to go be the student of this, the intern, if you will, of this medicine man in Indonesia.
Are you going to write fiction again?
Yeah, I'm working on a novel now.
You mentioned, I hope I'm not giving anything away here, transporting people, that people need a transporting metaphor. I think that's so true. Give me one. Come on.
A transporting metaphor.
No, this is your actual life, so it's not really a metaphor, and yet it provides them, I mean, for someone...
That's what I think religion is. You know, I think that, you know, religious ideas or spiritual ideas always begin as a big transporting metaphor. You know, we can't get to God literally. You know, we can only get to God figuratively. That's just the only way we can reach that. We can bridge that enormous distance between the mortal and the eternal is with an idea. You know, and what you need is an idea that appeals to you enough or moves you enough or stirs you enough or elevates you enough that it changes your sort of interior, molecules and your interior monologue as well. And that metaphor is the boat that kind of takes you across that figurative distance between you and the divine. And I think that's what religions are based on. I think the problem is what happens when people, what fundamentalism is in any religion, is when people start to take the metaphor literally, you know, and then get stuck in, you know, the law rather than the mystery. And so I've always been more attracted to the kind of mystery of divinity than the law.
And the cat tied to that pole, which we won't talk about that. You just have to read the book. If you want to know why the kitty is tied to the pole. Well, it's just filled not only... I mean, it's just entertaining. Even, number one, when I read the first page, I'm like, oh, no. You know, I'm like, it's a... You know, well, number one, I was freaked out because it's, you know, the Japamala and all that. But I thought, what am I getting into? And then it was like, she's normal. She's grounded. It's okay. I can do this.
I tried very hard in the first few pages to sort of establish, like, please don't worry. Please don't be alarmed. I'm not going to take you on a kooky freaking ride here.
But it is a kooky freaking ride.
But it's also an enjoyable one, and it's also a normal one, and it's also a human one, and it's a universal one, and we all have it.
It's more everyday than you might think. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I do think, you know.
And yet it was extraordinary what happened to you.
Yeah, that too.
It was kind of like Carlos Castaneda, and kind of like, you know, and that you can do it. Are you still doing it?
Yeah, I'm still doing it.
That is really cool.
Still doing it.
Well, and I believe you. I mean, I do.
Thanks.
Well, you're welcome.
I'm glad.
I have every reason to. We won't get into it now. But, so you will write fiction again.
I will.
Where are you going to go with your fiction?
I'm going to Brazil. I'm writing a novel about Brazil right now. Not right now, actually. What I'm doing right now is steadfastly, you know, promoting this book that I just wrote.
That's true.
Which is an enormous job, but also really a cool job because it's, you know, me and this book had no difference between us for the whole journey. It was like anything that happened to the book happened to me. Anything that happened to me was in the book. It was like this complete kind of umbilical relationship. And now that the book exists on its own, it's really fun and wonderful for me to watch it going out in the world and having all these adventures on its own, traveling to places I'll never go, meeting people I'll never meet, you know, like interacting as a sort of ambassador. It's fantastic. I really have enjoyed watching that happen more than with any book I've ever written.
It's getting quite a bit of attention, isn't it?
Yeah, it's doing good.
I'm totally out of it. I have to tell you, I'm just somebody who just doesn't know.
Yeah.
And so it is, isn't it? It was like a New York Times. A friend told me, she goes, oh, that book, New York Times, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay. I don't know.
I don't pay attention to stuff either unless it happens to be my book. So I do happen to know that. In this case, I do know what's up. As somebody said to me the other day, is this book selling better than your other books? I was like, yeah. You know, you write the big, you know, divorce memoir. It just turns out that more people relate to it than the little, you know, literary collection of short fiction. So it's not really a big surprise that it's doing really well. But, you know, there's just a bottomless number of women especially who can relate to this story, you know, to this feeling of waking up and feeling like you're in someone else's skin and just having to radically dismantle or wanting to radically dismantle your life and build it up again in a different way. I think that that's a story we all know.
The sense that I get you from you, well, from reading your book, is that you're more of a toughie than you appear in person. And I don't mean tough. What is it? I mean tough like those kids in Naples, you know? I mean tough like, and I got to go to Naples now. Got to go to Naples. Definitely, it's down there. I'm convinced. Naples and Bologna.
Oh, my God, the food in Bologna is so good. It makes my stomach hurt just thinking about it. So good.
Yeah.
The food in Italy is so great. It's such an art, and I love that they're defending it. You know, I love that they're, like, defending it as hard as they can against fast food. You know, that whole slow food culture came from Italy in the last few years. It was a rebellion against fast food, that they started the slow food movement. And it's, you know, this concerted political effort to preserve the idea of cooking food slowly and eating it slowly instead of making it and eating it fast. And there's just a lot of grace in that. I just dig it.
Take hours over your meal.
Take days to make something and then a couple more days to eat it. You know, why not? What a great way to spend a couple days.
I think I just need to go to Rome because of the one word you decided describes it. But people will have to read the book to find out what that is. Or can we say that?
You can say that.
It's sex. Yeah. I think we can still say sex on the air. I don't think it's one of those words that's been banned yet.
Yeah.
Yet. But sex is okay then.
In Italy?
Just spiritually, guilt as far free. As you're concerned.
Guilt-free.
Guilt-free.
Constant. I mean, not that I had any. I had much more pasta than I had anything sexual there. I was looking for pleasure in different ways. Just because I felt like I really kind of needed a break from, you know, from that kind of business. But it's in the air. And it's in the food. And it's in the wine. It's in the fountains. It's everywhere. Sex. Italy.
It exudes it.
It exudes
their port.
It. Yeah.
But you just felt that it wasn't for you. But
not at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had other things I needed to do.
Not as a place to settle, but
yeah.
A beautiful place to visit.
Yeah.
Perhaps honeymoon someday. Right?
Maybe.
Yeah. You got to go back and have some pizza. Right? I mean, at least for that reason.
I'm going to go back and marry that pizza.
Do you? I'm ready to marry the pizza. Just from reading your book, I'm ready to marry that pizza. And have gelato in the morning. You know, with my cappuccino.
You gotta love the Italians for that. You know, the really funny thing is that it's now that I've gotten back, people have sometimes asked me, not so much on the West Coast, but on the East Coast, where we're a little more pathological. People say things like, well, don't you think it was a little self-indulgent of you to go spend this year, you know, exploring yourself, which is a question I never got in California, which reminds me, California is still the place where people do believe that, you know, spiritual journeys are your human right, you know, however you want to make them. But also, I never got that question in Italy. You know, an Italian never said to me, what are you doing here? Why aren't you being responsible? And, you know, they got it. You know, when I came to Italy, I said, look, I've been really sad. I'm trying to jumpstart my sense of myself again. I want to use pleasure as a kind of rope to pull me out of sadness. They were like, complimenti, vai avanti, go ahead, be our guest. Yeah, of course. Like, they get that. You know, I needed to explain no more than one sentence to any Italian for them to absolutely understand why I was going to do that and how to do that and for them to embrace it.
Well, if you could take that aspect of their culture and then the familial bonds in Bali and somehow mush them together so that...
That's the effort.
But you learned different forms of meditation there from the little...
From my Yoda medicine man?
Yeah. How do you say his name?
Catutlier.
Catut.
Catut.
Catut, which is a number?
Yeah, that means fourth.
Fourth. He's the fourth son.
Fourth born
Everybody
child.
Has four names.
Yeah, there's only four names in Bali. They kind of pass them around. And birth order is extremely important. So, but no, it's great. I mean, they really know who they are.
You met some fascinating people there.
Yeah.
And the way you describe people so cutely. I can't believe I should sell your book. I should just be hawking it on the corner here. This is a great book. I actually, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, I need to... You know, buy this for
this person, and I need to buy this for that person. It's almost sort of a salve.
Well,
for
do
them.
You know what I really want it to be? I really want it to be, like, I don't want to be poster child for leave your husband and move to India. You know, that's what I had to do because that's me, you know, and the way that I recovered from my divorce was with this journey because that's how I am. It reflects me. It resembles me. It's my thing, you know. But what I do want is to encourage people to consider giving themselves the permission to ask such astonishingly radical questions as, you know, what would I like to do with my time on earth? What would I like to do with the remaining days of my life? What kind of person do I want to be? What, you know, what am I here for? And what is stopping me from experiencing that? And that is something I'm really happy to become a little bit of a evangelist for.
Well, the people that I know are all single women like myself. And for me, you know, I didn't get the impression that, you know, leave that man. I didn't get that impression at all.
Oh, that's good.
For me, it was more, like you say, if there's something that's weighing you down,
yeah,
and you're letting it eat away at you, that you do have the control to.
And if you can do
yourself.
A little kind of CAT scan on yourself every once in a while and see if there are, you know, when you're feeling low or if you're in a dark corner and you've been there for a while, if you can kind of do this kind of, this is how I used to come to think of it. I would do that every morning. I would sort of look through myself and think, are there any clusters of cells here that are not destroyed? Is there anything that isn't corroded? Is there anything that can still respond to expansion, to light, to excitement? You know, is there anything that wants to live in a really vibrant way? What can I do to feed that and encourage that? That's how I started taking Italian, because the only thing I could come up with for a while was I would really like to learn Italian. That's the only thing I can imagine doing that would make me happy. And so I started taking Italian with no plan to ever go to Italy or do anything with it, you know. But it just was, you know, those 2 hours of Italian classes a week were the only time where I was like sort of deliriously excited again. And so I was feeding that, you know, and I think you feed that and see where it takes you. And it's kind of surprising where you might end up if you allow yourself to find out.
You might end up in Italy.
You might end up in Italy. You might end up stuffing your face with pizza in Naples.
I need to learn Portuguese. I don't have that overwhelming desire. That's the part, I guess, that I would meditate on is what, you know, give me a, you know, is it, it or should I be happy if I'm content?
No. If you're content, you should be miserable. Of course you should be happy if you're content. And I also like, you know, our greatest living spiritual master in America, Howard Stern, said,
oh, good Lord,
recently in an interview, I actually heard him say this, and I thought, damn, that's really great. He said, you know, people go all over the world to find happiness and change their lives and, you know, spend all this money on therapy and all this stuff that we do to try to bring contentment into our lives. He said, but sometimes it's as simple as leaving an hour early for work once a week, going to your favorite coffee shop by yourself, getting your favorite cup of coffee, your favorite muffin, and reading the newspaper alone for an hour without anybody bothering you, and giving yourself that once a week. And I was like, you know, I just went all the way around the world to get to the, sort of the same place. But he's right. You know, like, not everyone does have to do this or can, by the way. You know, like, people's lives, you know, hold them in various ways that they either have agreed to or not agreed to, but they might get stuck somewhere or they can't move. But can you give yourself that sort of amazing coffee shop hour once a week? And is that enough? You know, like, just something to do to feed your sense that you're not just, you know, moving through your life like a robot, you know, but that you're doing something that makes you feel alive and real.
Is there anything that you'd want to mention about your sister's book coming out? You want to talk about that?
That is so cool of you to say.
That's all right.
Oh, my God. My big sister, Catherine, who I love so much, Catherine Murdoch is her name, has a book coming out this spring. And it's a young adult novel called Dairy Queen. And it's about a girl from a dairy farm in Wisconsin who ends up playing football for her high school football team, and it's so good, and it avoids every possible cliche that just ran through your head when you imagined the idea of a girl playing football. Like, it's nothing what you'd expect. It's a beautiful book, and she got a giant, massive, huge pile of money for it from Houghton Mifflin. They gave her like the most money they ever gave anyone for a young adult novel. They love it, and it's great, and it's coming out in the spring. It's called Dairy Queen, and it's fantastic. And
wow.
I think it's going to be one of those crossover kid books, you know, that grown-ups read.
How do you say it?
Attraversiamo. Let's cross over.
I am going to learn Italian, too, and Portuguese.
Good.
You've inspired me.
Va bene.
And I'm going to go to Naples and get Marguerite, pizza Marguerite.
With extra cheese.
With extra cheese. Thank you for being with us in the studio today. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of The Last American Man, and most recently, Eat, Pray, Love.
You're listening to KABU Community Radio, 90.7 FM. It's 9:31. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, the guests are Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old peace activist who was killed in 2003 when she was crushed by a bulldozer on the Gaza Strip. The Coreys will discuss the first annual PeaceWorks Conference, which will be held this weekend in Olympia. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, Willamette Radio Workshop presents 4 Hours from Omaha by Craig Kenworthy, an original radio play dealing with an elder woman's attempt to balance her life. Up next, Kathleen Stevenson's guest is economist Jared Bernstein, author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy.
I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. His areas of research include income inequality and mobility trends in employment and earnings, low-wage labor markets and poverty, international comparisons, and the analysis of federal and state economic policies. His new book is called All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. Jared Bernstein, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
One of your main points, I think, is that current models for our economy stress an ever-shrinking role for government and an ever-increasing risk for individuals, sort of like you're on your own, make the best of it, I think. Can you talk about that, what that does for us and how it sort of came to be?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things it does for us, particularly from an economic sense, is that we lose many of the benefits, both political and economic benefits, of pooling risk and essentially working in a more collaborative manner to solve some of the problems we face. If you look at just the thematics or the DNA behind some of the policies that are being promoted these days, privatizing Social Security, turning these health savings accounts over to the consumer, personal responsibility accounts for unemployment insurance. I mean, this notion that everything can be reduced to a private account so that it's you against the labor market, you against the health insurers, you against globalization. This is a real core thematic of the group that I call Yo-Yo, the you're on your owners. And it does certainly fit their theme of diminishing government to the point where it plays a relatively small role in the lives of its citizens. And I have a problem with that on numerous levels.
And it seems to me that some people have been convinced that this is a more equitable way to do things, that people are more able to support themselves that way, that they won't be brought down by those at the lower levels. Do you address that?
Yeah, I very much focus on this point. In fact, you know, I don't think there are too many people arguing that this you're-on-your-own approach to economic and social policy is more equitable. What I hear people saying is that it's more efficient, is that somehow it takes the clumsy behemoth of government intervention out of the market economy. And at the bottom of all this is this belief that kind of a market economy driven by powerful corporations will achieve the best outcomes. To the extent that the inequalities are generated, you know, through that model, perhaps you could fix them by redistributing, you know, through some social programs. I think where I really differ from that view is that I see no evidence that this kind of you're-on-your-own approach to economic policy leads to better economic or more efficient economic outcomes. To the contrary, what I think it does is lead to far more inequality. And that's one of the things I spend a great deal of time talking about and documenting in the book, the idea that what you're told essentially as a listening public is that, you know, if we simply take the handcuffs off the invisible hands of the economy and let the private sector rip, we'll all be better off. What you actually get is wealth more and more narrowly concentrated among those at the top of the scale.
I believe that you also discuss a sort of shift that's happened in our society, a shift from an attempt to look at the collective source of action. And what happened? Are you talking about sort of the programs that started with Social Security in that era, or what does that go back to, and how did it shift?
Well, I mean, I think the analysis can take you back really to the Roaring Twenties, or even back before that, where in the late 1800s, you had various periods throughout our economic history when the notion that, you know, the business of America is business and what's good for GM is good for America, et cetera. There's been periods throughout our economic history where this notion that any kind of regulation, government intervention, any opportunities we take to kind of smooth out some of the difficulties that you encounter in a market economy are going to do more harm than good. And in fact, if you think back to the 1920s, this was a period of unprecedented wealth accumulation. It was also a period of speculative bubbles and ultimately a precedent of a very destructive economic period, i.e. the Great Depression. Now, I'm not saying that at all that's what we're looking at now. Far from it. We thankfully have enough protective kinds of policies built into the economy such that I don't think that will occur. But we do, once again, have wealth levels that are wealth concentration levels that look much like those of the latter 1920s. We have speculative bubbles, and we have a great deal of debt as a result. So there are these similar imbalances in the economy.
And was there a shift somehow from the policies that included collective action? Was there a shift in the recent past to more of this attitude? And if so, when and how did that happen?
Yes, there certainly was a shift. In fact, I talk about it in the book in the context of risk shifting. I think there's been an ongoing shift over the past 25 years that have essentially shifted risk from the shoulders of government and many of our nation's firms onto individuals and their families. You see this most clearly in the area of health care, where employer-provided health care, the primary mechanism through which most of us get our health insurance, has been diminished and is falling at a pretty alarming rate. Employers are simply not covering as many workers as they used to, and therefore, even in a growing economy like ours, we have 46 million uninsured people, a problem that gets bigger year after year. Pension systems have eroded as well. The minimum wage is at a 50-year low. Unions are a much smaller share of the workforce than they've ever been. There's been a great deal of deregulation, and it's showing up in many of the ways I've just mentioned.
And we were just having a conversation about that with a group of people I was sitting with related to health care and the choice of health care plans, where now many people are faced in their group work situations with having to choose a health plan, and the younger members of that group want to take a plan that emphasizes lower cost because they have less risk, and the older members may be a little more afraid of what might happen to them and the kind of health care they might need, and they are sort of in a way pitted against each other in having to choose because the lower amount of health care is presented as a bargain. Can you address that?
No, I think that's a good example. I mean, if you look at the kinds of ideas that what I call the yo-yos, the you're on your own crowd, are proposing to solve this healthcare problem or even crisis that we're looking at in terms of the lack of coverage, instead of taking a page from every other advanced economy where universal coverage is the norm and they insure about 100% of their citizenship, and spend a lot less GDP doing it, we're trying to figure out ways to cut costs by exactly the method you described. If you essentially set up a set of accounts that encourage people to gamble, the idea is that you'll sign up for these this so-called health savings accounts, and you'll have some basically a bank account that you can invest as you like. If you get sick and go to the doctor, you're going to have to dip into it and use that money. And that takes money out of your account, and therefore your that asset is going to grow less quickly. Well, the problem with that is it creates an incentive not to pursue medical treatment if you need it. It also is going to be a magnet for people who are young and are healthy, or at least think they're healthy, and leaves the rest of us out of the plan. That means that now you have a big group that's more likely to need health care, and they're not covered by this health insurance plan. So economists call it adverse selection. I mean, you have a problem here where the folks who are least likely to participate in the plan probably need health coverage the most. They're going to be the most expensive, and it's just an accident going out to happen.
I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein. He is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and his new book is called All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. What do you think it will take for us to shift back to having more of a sense of collective awareness in how we make policies and what kind of policies our nation has towards these various areas of our economic and social service life?
Well, for one, we're going to have to regain our faith in the ability of government to function effectively and efficiently and be a source of good. I mean, it's pretty tough to make an argument that the government can help solve our problems when you look at the way some of the big problems that we've faced have been handled. And of course, I'm thinking of Katrina, but you could talk about Iraq and so many other problems. The fact is that for the last 20 years, it's not just a Republican or a Democratic thing. This is not an attack on the Bush administration solely. Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over, and while the Clinton administration accomplished some very good things, we have a real problem in that our federal government probably isn't up to the task, given the folks who are in places of fairly high office, and their views stand in stark contrast to those I've been expressing. So I think the electorate has to recognize that what I have talked about in the book, the idea that this you're on your own philosophy is ultimately very hurtful and harmful, and more of a we're in this together kind of ethic would help move us ahead. Once that's the case, then presumably I think we could start electing officials who represent our interests in the way we've been talking about for the last few minutes. But this could take a decade of repairing the damage that's been done, restaffing agencies from the bottom up with competent people. You know, you think about this agency, FEMA, that's taken so much flack. This is an agency that performed very effectively under Bill Clinton when some of the big disasters occurred in the 90s, Hurricane Andrew and the Northridge earthquake. FEMA had a great record then. But when Bush was elected, G.W. Bush was elected, he appointed one of his campaign guys to run FEMA. And this guy inveighed against FEMA from the start, saying, you know, this is an agency that really isn't particularly necessary today, and you ought to look to your churches and your community institutions to take up the slack. I quote this in the book. So that's a great example of the way we have really put people in charge who, through this you're on your own, this yo-yo philosophy, are undermining our ability to collaboratively solve problems that we face.
Do you give any credence to the view sometimes mentioned that the unstated objective of the current administration is to just basically gradually bankrupt social services programs so that there will be fewer and fewer resources and there will be nothing to really draw from?
You know, I think there are some people who believe in that, and I talk about it in the book under this rubric of starve the beast. There are some folks, actually they tend to be outside of the administration, and their argument is, look, we can't really shrink government through legislation, so we're going to shrink government by starving it of revenue. We'll just cut taxes until we simply can't finance these programs anymore. And I think they're, you know, the very cynical types that you're describing. I think within the administration, there are those who, you know, believe that individuals on their own with private accounts will simply always outperform any, you know, kind of public sector initiative to deal with the challenges we face. And as an economist, I have great respect for what an individual can do in a private market. But when it comes to globalization, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to the largest concentration of wealth since the 1920s, there's simply no path that an individual can follow on their own to meet these challenges. I mean, globalization is something I write a lot about in the book. It's a great example because if you're just kind of on your own and without any national policy to confront this, then sure, you're going to see industries crumbling under the under foreign competition. The auto industry is the last best example. But if we get together, as I suggest, and come up with a national plan for revitalizing some of our key industries, then we can make a difference. It's just that you have to be willing to work collaboratively and start to try to solve these problems instead of waving your hands and say, well, the private market's always better. You're on your own is the way to go.
You recently wrote a piece that was printed in, was it the Washington Post?
Right.
Plan to End Child Poverty. And maybe we could talk briefly about that just as an example of one particular issue and how you've seen it addressed and as a model for what we could do here.
Exactly. I mean, I've talked a lot about this yo-yo, you're on your own theme that runs through the book, but I haven't said much about this other theme, wit, or we're in this together. And when I was in the United Kingdom trying to learn about their initiative to end child poverty by 2020, I saw a wit society at work. Back in 99, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, announced that they would like to end child poverty in the UK by 2020. I mean, almost an outlandish idea that he just came up with in a speech. But instead of just figuring out how public officials could backtrack away from that, they rolled their sleeves up and started to implement a whole set of policies to accomplish that goal. They introduced a cabinet-level unit called the Social Exclusion Unit that was going to work on creating greater inclusion of some folks who have been left out of the economy that's actually been doing pretty well over there. They raised the minimum wage. They introduced a system of tax credits to subsidize low-wage work. They created a much better child care system so that parents who went to work would have reliable, safe, and useful places to leave their kids. I mean, useful in the sense that the kids could learn something. And they actually spent some significant money on doing this. What was interesting to me and motivation for the article you mentioned is they actually missed their first target slightly. They, instead of reducing poverty by 25% at this stage, their interim target, they reduced it by 20 or so. And this was a cause of great concern. And instead of trying to cover it up or back away from it or explain how an agency's got the numbers wrong or something, they talked about what they were going to do to redouble their efforts. And to me, it was just a great example of what you can do when you try to work together to solve a national problem.
Jared Bernstein, is there anything you'd like to say in the concluding minutes of this interview that gets to the basic points of your new book, Altogether Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy, something perhaps we haven't mentioned?
Well, I guess the only thing I'd say is that when I talk to people, and I've been trying to go around the country a bit and see if where people stand on these issues, I get a sense of just a vague discomfort as to where things are headed. And I really believe that people of almost all stripes, be they blue or red staters, are unsettled by the way things are unfolding and how they're developing. And one of the reasons, of course, the war is making all of us very nervous, and the costs seem to just be high and endless in that regard. But I think there's beginning to be a sense that we can no longer be led by ideologues who just kind of refuse to get outside of a bubble and see things differently. I think there's a will to maybe get to embrace a different vision where we eschew some of these individualist, hyper-individualist ideas and work together to meet some challenges.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us and talking about these issues, writing about these issues.
My pleasure.
And I wanted to let people know I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein. He is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute His new book is All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KABU. Kathleen Stevenson again, and with me on the line from somewhere south of Portland is Leslie Adams with the Oxygen Collective. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, the Oxygen Collective is challenging the Bush administration's plans to clear-cut forest in Oregon's largest unprotected roadless areas this summer. And you are traveling with your 40-foot biodiesel bus through Western Oregon for 4 scheduled appearances. Can you talk a little bit about why you're doing this?
Yeah, I apologize for any feedback. I'm actually traveling on our bus on I-5 right now, so it's a little loud. But, before the ashes of the Biscuit Fire really had time to cool, the Bush administration was plotting on how to seize the Biscuit Fire as an opportunity to unravel environmental laws, and also, of course, to pay back the timber industry supporters who helped bankroll Bush's 2000 campaign. And so a lot of the listeners, I'm sure, are pretty well aware about the controversy and the protests that happened last summer out at the Biscuit regarding unprecedented logging in old-growth reserves. Unfortunately, the Bush administration has not given up, and now they're coming back for more. They have proposed to log in 2 inventoried roadless areas, the South and North Chelmiapsis, and it's the largest unprotected roadless forest in Oregon, actually on the west coast from Baja, Mexico, up to British Columbia, Canada. And so we're taking it on the road again to let the public know about this most recent assault on our natural heritage. And given the fact that millions of Americans rode in support of Clinton's 2001 roadless area conservation rule, we believe that the majority of Americans adamantly oppose this type of proposal on our public lands. And so the Oxygen Collective is hitting the road to educate people and let folks know that this will be the first time that the administration would be logging in areas that are supposed to be protected under Clinton's rule.
And just how close do you think this area is to being logged, especially the Biscuit Burn area?
Well, there's 2 sales. One's called the Mike's Gold Sale. That's in the South Chelmiapsis, and then the Blackberry Sale in Indigo Creek in the North Chelmiapsis. And they're both supposed to be auctioned off this summer. So we're definitely looking at imminent logging later this summer.
And talk a little bit about the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act and what that might mean.
Right. Well, the Biscuit, like I said, was the Bush administration quickly seized on this fire as an opportunity to unravel environmental laws. They're doing that right now through the roadless rule. They're also doing that through H.R. 4200, or this is also more commonly known as Walden's logging bill. And it just recently passed committee in the House, and what it would do would strip environmental laws and public process to allow federal agencies to go in quickly after any natural event, not just fires, but windstorms and ice storms, floods, and go in and log these areas while sidestepping environmental laws and public review. And maybe the most common or well-known law that's being affected by this is the Endangered Species Act. And the proposed law as it is right now actually has no protections for roadless areas or old-growth reserves at all. It's just kind of a free-for-all letting timber companies come in after these natural disturbances and clear-cut our natural heritage.
And where does this bill stand now in Congress?
Like I said, it just passed a committee in the House, and so it'll be up for a vote in the House pretty soon. And I encourage folks to contact Peter DeFazio and Wu and Julian Blumenhauer and let them know that this legislation is not based on science whatsoever. Actually, a letter was sent to Congress a few weeks ago signed by 169 scientists across the country saying that H.R. 4200 is not based on sound science. It's much more a product of political wrangling than solid science, and these scientists asked that it not be passed. And so I encourage folks to call their representatives and ask them to not vote in support of H.R. 4200. And then, of course, Gordon Smith, our Republican senator, has a Senate version, and we're hoping that's not going to go anywhere either. So I encourage folks to call Senator Wyden as well and make sure that he's going to stand up for sound science.
Now, Leslie, the Oxygen Collective is also, is it true that you are joining in support of the man, Adrian Haley, who climbed a 60-foot tree outside Representative Ryan Baird's Vancouver, Washington office?
Correct, yeah. We were planning on heading up and joining our bus in support of his action. Unfortunately, his tree set has been taken down, but we really respect and appreciate his work to draw attention to Brian Baird's involvement in H.R. 4200. He's a co-sponsor along with Greg Walden. And as a statistician, it's pretty disturbing that as a statistician and an environmentalist and claiming sound science is something that he supports, it's very disturbing that he's supporting this bill.
Okay, so your actions go not only throughout Oregon, but you go up into Washington. Is the bus going up into that area too?
This leg of the tour right now is just in Oregon, and we're going to be at the Clinton Street Theater tonight at 7:30 in Portland, and then we're doing shows in Eugene and Medford. We're going to be doing another leg of a tour later in May that's going to go up into Washington, and then early June we'll be down in California.
And what's going to be happening at the Clinton Street tonight?
Well, I encourage folks to come on down. We have our bus is full of 12 people that are, we have mothers and musicians and farmers and students. And what we're doing is a multimedia presentation. It's a call to action. And we're going to give folks kind of an early history of the biscuit saga and get folks up to speed most of the evening on updating folks what's been happening and the resistance on the ground last summer when they were logging old growth reserves, and then looking towards this summer when they're going to try and go into roadless areas. And we do believe that with public support, science, and economics on our side, we will be able to stop this roadless area logging, but we really need the help of everyone out there in many different ways. And so we're asking folks to show up tonight. We have cool videos, we have live music, we have amazing slideshows, and inspiring speakers, and then we're going to offer all kinds of ways for people to plug in, from very simple little actions to coming on down this summer and spending some time with us field checking these roadless areas.
Great. Well, wish you luck on your trip and your work. So thank you very much, Leslie Adams of the Oxygen Collective. And again, she and others tonight are going to be at the Clinton Street Theater at 2522 Southeast Clinton. That's at 7:30 p.m. And Leslie, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
And stay tuned. Coming up will be Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher, and she'll be speaking with Craig and Cindy Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey.
To propaganda, patriotism, juvenile delinquency, stereotypes, and smoking bans have in common. They're all topics being looked into for this month's edition of The Underground, the KBOO Youth Collective's public affairs show. The theme for this month is war and conflict, so be sure to tune in on the 26th of April at 6 p.m.
And also tune in April 21st at 9 p.m. for a super awesome special version of Randomonium Ultimonium! Kids from all over the country are going to be visiting the KBOO Air Room to share their favorite music with us.
And the following week, on the 28th, there's Play an Old Regular Randomonium at 11 p.m. Still kind of awesome.
So mark your calendars and make sure you get your recommended daily allowance of youth.
KBOO.
Cebu Community Radio is proud to host the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference in Portland this April for the first time ever. Community radio stations from around the nation will converge here for 5 days of idea sharing and creating new networks of community media. Come celebrate with us at our conference showcase event at the Doug Fir Lounge, Friday, April 21st from 8 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. The evening will feature an international musical mix of Portland's finest local talent, including local salsa legends Conjunto Alegre, live Afrobeat from Jujuba, as well as belly dance from Just Like Goddesses and bonger from KBOO's own DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. For more details, visit KBOO.fm. All proceeds benefit KBOO Community Radio.
Whoops, that went out over the air. Yikes! You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up at 11 on Democracy Now!, topics include outrage in Milwaukee over an all-white jury's decision to acquit three white police officers charged with brutality, beating an African-American man, and legendary Nigerian playwright Wole Soyinka talks about the ongoing crisis in Darfur. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. Willamette Radio Workshop presents 4 hours from Omaha by Craig Kenworthy, an original radio play dealing with an elder woman's attempt to balance her life. And now, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher's guests are Craig and Cindy Corey, parents of Rachel Corey. The topic is this weekend's first annual PeaceWorks Conference.
Michelle Schroeder Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Today by phone from Washington, we're speaking with Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of late Rachel Corey, peace and social activist, who died standing to protect a home and family in Gaza. Good morning.
Good morning.
You'll be telling us some important information about this up-and-coming event in Olympia, April 22nd and 23rd. But before we talk about this event, can you remind our listeners of Rachel and the details surrounding her death and the Rachel Corey Foundation? Give us some background.
Sure. Rachel was our youngest child. In 2003, she traveled to the West Bank for training with the International Solidarity Movement and then went immediately to the Gaza Strip, to Rafah, which is at the very southern tip of the Gaza Strip. She worked there for almost 2 months with the International Solidarity Movement, working with Palestinians who are and continue to this day to nonviolently resist the Israeli occupation. And while she was there, she was engaged in a lot of different kinds of work. She slept at wells that were had been threatened with demolition. Two had been destroyed, and internationals were called upon to help while water workers were repairing those wells. They would be fired on by from towers, Israeli towers that were in place there at the time, and would where firing would happen towards the workers. They slept in homes that were threatened with demolition because of their location along the border strip with Egypt that Craig and I have visited there now and saw the area. It was just completely cleared of homes in order to clear a buffer area along this border. A tenth of the population of Rafah have lost their homes, according to Human Rights Watch. That's over 16,000 people. So Rachel and other activists were there trying to prevent these demolitions by sleeping in the homes and connecting with the families who were threatened with this. They worked with, Rachel worked with women's groups, with children's groups, trying to build connections. She had dreams. She had talked to a local person here who was involved in setting up a sister city relationship with Santa Tomas, Nicaragua, and Rachel had this dream of being able to do a similar thing with Rafa. So her approach to it was really quite broad. She had spent a lot of time thinking about the work that she was going to do there. She had studied Arabic. And then on March 16th, 2003, she was called to the spot, actually, where she was killed because there were two bulldozers and an APC vehicle in the area. They were, clearing and threatening structures that were still there. So some of the activists that were there called Rachel and a couple others over. There were eight of them there that afternoon for a couple of hours. They stood in between the homes that were on the border and this equipment, and the bulldozers would come up to them and stop at their feet. That actually pushed one other activist into razor wire. He had to be kind of extracted from that, but they stopped. And then at one point they retreated to the border area. The activists thought they had been successful in preventing demolitions that day and called back to their coordinator to say that that was the case. But then the equipment returned. And
Cindy, when you're talking about the equipment, the picture is bulldozers and land clearing that's going on in a pretty large scale, like we would think of deconstructing of homes here.
They're actually larger than anything that you would see here, because a D9 bulldozer it's armored, for instance, so it weighs about 65 tons and is it's sort of the top of the line of bulldozers that you'd see. So it's
and specifically designed for like almost a military type.
It is, okay. When it, particularly when it's armored, as these are, so
okay.
That you cannot shoot into it with a normal sort of rifle. The it's perfectly protected, and these bulldozers stand close to 2 stories high. They're very large, immense machines. So it's much larger than something you'd see out on the normal work site here.
Okay, I was trying to get a picture, for our listeners and myself.
There were 2 bulldozers there that day. Each bulldozer had its operator and then another person on board, the commander of the bulldozer, and so 2 people looking out in each bulldozer, and then an armored personnel carrier, which is sort of a small tank. It's kind of like a tank without the cannon that you would see on, on TV when you're looking at a tank.
Okay. Thank you for that description. And I'm sorry, Cindy, continue.
Sure. And what happened at that point was that the bulldozers returned to the area. And we know from what we've read in the report that came from the Israeli military that has never been released to our government, but that we were finally able to read. We know that the orders were different that day, that the soldiers were told that they were not supposed to let the activists interfere with their work. According to the English translation that we've seen, and this was pointed out by members of the American embassy who read the report as well, that order was given, and 5 minutes later, the equipment came forward, and 5 minutes later, Rachel was killed. She was run over. According to eyewitnesses, the bulldozer preceded over her. She did, scramble to try to move away at that point once she realized it wasn't going to stop, but was unable to do that. It proceeded over her, it stopped, and then it backed over her again. And, of course, during that time, activists were shouting and waving and at the driver and so forth. And she died. She was, assisted by all of her friends there, and ambulance came and so forth, and she died shortly after that.
Well, Cindy and Craig, clearly there's nobody that hasn't been moved by this tragic story. And it so moved you that you started the Rachel Corrie Foundation. Like I said, it's just such a poignant personal thing to go on the website and to see the picture of her, this young, vital, alive girl who, by her own admission, was a peace and social justice activist, but she was also a pretty typical college enlightened, aware person who just said, can't I make a difference? Can't we all? And really was committed to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And sometimes you see all this sort of talk in on the internet or other places about Rachel, and they sort of it paints her in a different sort of picture than just another human being who looked out with compassion and some understanding at human beings everywhere. And I think Rachel, what was different a little bit about Rachel than some of us, what she tried to teach us, is that we had to look beyond the obvious to what our choices were doing to people in far parts of the world. And she was capable of doing that and capable, I think, of making others do that as well.
Well, certainly. It's really apparent. And there's also been really current. And like I said, I do want to remind our listeners that we will get to the really important work of event that's coming to South Puget Sound Community College in Olympia, Washington, put on by the Corys, April 22nd and 23rd. But like I said, the background is so important to the concept that I think it's really important.
Well, you know, Rachel brought us to this issue and to this work. She really brought us to the issue. Once we learned that she was going to make this journey, is when we really started to focus on it and to learn so much more. After she was killed, we had a lot of people wanting to do something and reaching out to us looking for things to do. And one example that we had was with Linda Beale, whose daughter Amy Beale was killed in South Africa when she was registering voters there for the first election in which everyone could participate. And Linda, we met a couple weeks after Rachel was killed in Seattle. And I looked at her and asked her, are you ever able to retrieve any part of your previous life? And I'll always remember her contemplating that question and then looking at me and saying, not really. But then what she did tell me is what she and her family did, which was to try to really connect in a very personal way to the people of South Africa, and they started a foundation, and that continues, and the work of it continues. And so we had this example. So we started to think about a foundation, and it was a place where we could put some of the financial gifts that were coming our way, and that we could try to carry on some of Rachel's work, which we see as trying to build connections to other parts of the world, and to build that understanding about the impact that we're having on other parts of the world. Right now, our focus is very much on Israel and Palestine because of all the work that remains to be done there. But we see the foundation eventually, you know, expanding to other interests, partially because Rachel had a lot of other interests. All of these things we feel are connected in some way, and so I think we hope that the foundation will give voice to that as well eventually. But right now, we're engaged in this very big project, which
yes.
is this conference.
Yes, and that's what we want to focus for a minute and let our listeners know that about this new conference that's coming up just a weekend away. This weekend at April 22nd and 23rd, and it's up in Olympia, Washington. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about the format? And I know there's seminars, and it's just a fabulous, interesting action that you're going to take, these participation and action workshops and everything else.
Yeah, actually, the main part of the conference does go on over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and it'll be at the community college. But we're actually starting it out as early with pre-conference activities as early as Thursday night.
I just lost a connection.
Okay. Well, can you hear us, Cindy? Because I can hear you. Janet? Oh, well, it sounds okay. I can talk. Well, I am on air, and we have lost our connection, but I am going to inform our listeners as we're waiting to try and get that connection back that the name of the conference is Cultivating a Just and Enduring Peace for the People of Palestine and Israel. It's going to be at the South Puget Sound Community College in Olympia, Washington. And what it is an assembly of some of the most impassioned and powerful peace and justice voices. And they'll be conducting seminars and talks for 2 days in Olympia, Washington. And this is the first annual Peace Works event, and it's organized by the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. And I think you're back on the line?
Yes.
No, not a problem. It gave me an opportunity to give them the background and what was going to happen. And now I'm going to let you fill in starting on Thursday.
Yes, and what I was saying when the gods of the Internet or whatever interrupted me is that we're having Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, is speaking in Olympia on Thursday night at the Olympia Center for the Washington Center for the Performing Arts. And that's co-sponsored. Well, we have a lot of co-sponsors,
yeah.
But one of them is the city of Olympia. So that's free to the public. First 800 and some people that come can hear the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi talk about what his grandfather taught him in terms of peace and justice issues and how to work on those.
That's at 7 p.m., and it's building a culture of peace in our families, community, and the world.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And then on Friday, we have pre-conference activities at the Evergreen State College, which is where Rachel attended. That is called Putting Justice into Action. It's a day of discussion and workshops looking at issues of identity and oppression within solidarity work on this issue. And we have a panel of people that will be talking about what brings them to this work and what their experience is. And then all of our people who attend will have an opportunity to talk about that within workshops as well. There will be a problem jostle in the afternoon where the whole group will have a chance to determine what are the parts of this issue that they would most like to spend some time working on. We will have workshops that afternoon, and it's going to be a nice introduction for people that are able to get up here on Friday.
So, Cindy, you're talking about kind of what are some of the obstacles and challenges and the opportunities for people who kind of want to be involved or are involved in activism?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right. And
for people that are new to the issue, there will be sort of a Israel-Palestine 101 part of that, too. So we hope to be able to attract both people that have been working on this issue for a very long time and those that are new, like you said, and just want to learn about it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The structure on the day at Evergreen includes workshops late in the afternoon on anti-oppression, on healing activist trauma. As Craig mentioned, the Palestine-Israel 101, which will be done by Steve Naiva, who's a professor at the college, and also a session on campus divestment. So, and I think people will enjoy just being on the campus. There will be campus tours. There's a memorial area for Rachel that people, faculty friends of hers, have really maintained, and people will have an opportunity to go to that area of the campus. And then on Friday night, we have an event with Jerry and Sis Levin, which is going to be downtown in Olympia at the United Churches. The Levins have been working in the West Bank for some time. Jerry is with Christian Peacemaker Teams in Hebron. He was a CNN correspondent during the 80s, was the first correspondent in Beirut to be kidnapped and was held hostage for about a year. That was a transforming event in his life, and he's moved from that to doing this work in the West Bank with Christian Peacemaker Teams. Sis Levin works on nonviolent education in the West Bank, working with teachers and students. So they'll have a presentation at 7 p.m. at United Churches. It's also free to the public. And then on Saturday, we move to the South Puget Sound Community College. And that's where our actual conference is going to be held. And it's a 2-day conference that brings a wonderful array of speakers. We have Huwaida Arif, who is one of the co-founders of the International Solidarity Movement. She's a Palestinian-American. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who is a physician and ran second to Mahmoud Abbas last year in the Palestinian presidential
election.
Yeah, and this year he was elected, was one of the progressive candidates who was elected to the Palestinian parliament. He'll be with us on Sunday at the conference. And Diana Boutu is a Canadian-Palestinian lawyer and an advisor to the, has been an advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team. She will be with us on both Saturday and Sunday. Amira Haas, who is a well-known journalist in Israel, she writes for Haaretz and it has also written books. Drinking the Sea at Gaza is one that I'm most familiar with. She lived in Gaza. She now is living in the West Bank, I believe, and it has a very interesting personal story, I think, as well. Her family came out of the Holocaust experience, and but she's chosen to really report directly from Gaza and the West Bank, not from afar, and it's really quite remarkable. Dr. Sarah Roy, who is from Harvard and with the Middle Eastern Studies program there and has written a book on the de-development of Gaza, will be with us and talking about U.S. policy and U.S. foreign policy. She will be speaking with Diana Boutu on a panel that will be moderated by Alexander Coburn, who is with Counterpunch. Some of your listeners may be familiar with that. And Liat Weingart is with Jewish Voice for Peace. She does a great deal of work on activism around Caterpillar Corporation and so forth in this country, and we'll be talking a lot about that. We will have workshops, a series of workshops called Taking Action Workshops that we're very excited about. They are going to start on Saturday afternoon, and we'll cover a lot of areas that people doing this work are involved in: art in the service of activism, creating sister city relationships, bridging solidarity movements, lobbying and impacting party platforms, making corporations accountable, media monitoring, doing nonviolent direct action as a response, outreach and education, how we frame what the message is, how we determine what the message is at this time, and how we communicate that to people, how the faith community has responded to all of this. That's the list of workshops that we'll be offering. And what we're doing, though, is we will have resource people, a number of them, in each workshop, but our idea is to bring together people who have maybe done a little bit of work or no work or a lot of work on this, and to have them think about what are the critical things for us to be thinking about right now, what are the tools that we can share with one another as we try to work for a just and enduring peace in Israel and Palestine, and what are some strategies that working together maybe we can implement more effectively.
So it has the overarching peace and social justice, and the workshops can be applied to and all kinds of work done everywhere in the world. But especially this being the first year, a particular bent on Palestine and the situation in the Middle East.
That's right. And I think it was very important to us to include the workshop on bridging solidarity movements. And we'll have with us some people who have done a lot of work in Latin America and in other areas, working on Native American issues in this country and so forth, because we do feel like all of these things are connected and that we need to find ways to support one another while we're involved in whatever piece of this we work with most closely.
Well, before we go any further, I want to remind our listeners again that I'm speaking with Craig and Cindy Corey, who are involved in as they've been telling you, cultivating a just and enduring peace for the people of Palestine and Israel is the the broad heading, but it's a workshops and action that you, participations in workshops and development and sharing ideas. It's going to be at the South Puget Sound Community College April 22nd and 23rd, and then there's several other places. But the most important thing is for how people can find out more information. And my understanding is www.RachelCoreyFoundation, all one word?
That's right.
.org.
.org, right. And all the information is there about the different pieces of this, and people can register online if they would like to for the conference. And there's lots of information there for people. And it is www.RachelCoreyFoundation.org.
Well, I like I said, there's just so much. I can't imagine the work. You must have been working years to put together all of the fabulous speakers and all the wonderful events. It's really, people do need to go to the website just to see what's available, and it's got a wonderful breakdown of registration and who's speaking, and you have it broken out in time frames, and just a fabulous job.
Thank you. We've got a great group of volunteers. This is a huge volunteer effort, really. So we're very grateful and very proud of the work that people here are doing. And I just think it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful weekend, and we'd like people to join us.
Well, both of you, you know, like I said, again, I want to let everyone know that you can find out information about all of the workshops and the events and the speakers. Like she said, like Cindy has said, that they have Dr. Arun Gandhi, who is a social political activist, who is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, and just speaker after speaker of note and involvement on these really important social and peace issues. Again, you can go to www.RachelCoreyFoundation.org. And is there anything else you'd like to say in the remaining minutes that I might have forgotten to ask you?
I think you've done a great job, I'm glad for the opportunity. And the weather is beautiful here in Olympia right now. We're anticipating it's going to be a nice weekend. So I just hope people will go looking for that information and come join us for whatever peace they might be able to make. If they're able to come just one day, that's fine. We'd love to have them.
Well, I wanted to hear from both of you, and I wanted to take a moment to thank you personally for all the people's lives that both you and Rachel have affected. You know, we at KABU really understand and appreciate that the world owes you our thanks and support for all your efforts in peace and justice.
Oh, well, thank you, and I think that we're all working for the same sorts of things, so we're here together, and we certainly know that and get a lot of support from people in Portland and really all around the United States and the world.
Well, thank you again, you know, for, like I said, all that you've done and all your personal sacrifice. This really seems like it's going to be a wonderful and special event, and it's a great testimony to both her and you as her parents.
Thank you. So much.
Come join us.
Okay, we will.
Okay.
Thank you again. This is Michelle Schroeder Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.